So I just wanted you to see it.
Not my head. There it is. Morning. We will call the Senate Tax Committee to order for April 9th, 2015. Members, the folks from Laverne and Worthington are here, so we're going to do my bill first on the Lewis and Clark water system. And Senator Eaton, can you chair, please?
Oh, sure. So Senator Skoy has Senate File 1958.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And 1958 is a continuation of an effort that we started last year, kind of at the end of session. There's a pretty significant issue in southwest Minnesota obtaining fresh water for a number of cities, Laverne, Worthington, and other parts of that area of the state. On a relatively short timeline, we put together a bill that had some bonding money and a prospective state aid payment to those communities as they worked through the Lewis and Clark Regional Water System to bring water to their communities. It's a multi-state, I don't know if it's a compact, but a group of jurisdictions. I think there's 20 jurisdictions that are trying to provide water. We thought that at that time that we needed to be quite prompt in our response, so there was dollars put in the bonding bill for this, and we included a provision in the tax bill that did a number of things, but mostly it was authority to institute sales taxes and then use those sales taxes as approximately a 1-3 match for some state aid. Now, in the intervening year, and as happens occasionally, more information has come in. The projects have moved forward. Some of the sales taxes have been implemented. The city of Laverne has not implemented the sales tax. Rock County has not done what they were anticipated to do. So I drafted this Senate file, 1958, to bring the issue back in front of the tax committee again. Again, authorizing the city of Laverne to have sales tax authority of Rock County, but also removing some problematic language. We don't have all of that technical language fixed yet. And I think I'll say today that this is a work in progress because it is a very complicated structure that we're dealing with. It's a private organization dealing with three states on a complex timeline, delivering water to these jurisdictions where I think currently 11 of them have water, 9 of them do not. It takes a majority vote to move forward with these revenues. It's problematic in that the ones that have water are less likely to be supportive of the ones who don't. And so we're going to have to get creative in figuring out how we're going to resolve this issue today. But I'm here with folks from Worthington and from the Lewis and Clark Watershed District. There's also representatives from Laverne here. And they can talk to you about some of the issues. Senator Weber is here also, who is representing that area. And so I'd like to turn this over to the testifiers to explain some of the issues. And if I could have the indulgence of the committee, knowing that this is a work in progress, then we just have to have some language that we're working off of, and hence Senate File 1958 is in front of us today.
Whoever's going to begin, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Scott Hain, General Manager of Worthington Public Utilities. And Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony today on Senate File 1958. Senator Skoy gave you a pretty good background of what the project is. The issue that we were faced with, this project was authorized by Congress in 2000 and based on an ability to pay study, funding was to come 80% from the federal government, 10% from the states, 10% from the locals. Unfortunately, after a fairly significant injection of funding through the stimulus bill back in federal FY09, funding has fallen to a level that isn't even keeping pace with project cost inflation. At the current pace of federal funding, it's not anticipated that Worthington would receive water until 2045. At the urging of Governor Dayton a couple of years ago, we approached the state last year seeking an advance on federal funds with the intention that ultimately the federal government was going to fulfill their commitment, and that's why we term these as funding advances. The idea being that as the federal government fulfills their commitment, those funds would be returned back to the state. We're very grateful that last year the legislature did appropriate $22 million. That is, along with the project's FY14 federal funding, will allow for Rock County Rural Water and the City of Luverne to begin receiving water this fall, in the fall of 2015. As Senator Scoy indicated, last session the legislature also included a number of tax bill provisions in an attempt to provide a funding path for the completion of the Minnesota portion of the project and provide service to the remaining two members, which are Lincoln Pipestone Rural Water and the City of Worthington. Unfortunately, there were various language issues that made that funding mechanism unworkable. And while Senate File 1958 addresses one of the major issues, we don't believe that it addresses them all. But we're very appreciative of all the effort that has taken place to try to provide or help us provide funding for this project. And I guess with that, we'll just talk about a few of the key issues that we see remaining. Number one, what Senate File 1958 does, as Senator Scoy indicated, is remove some problematic language of utilizing future federal funds to buy down the state's debt service aid. The problem with that, as the Senator indicated, is the federal funding essentially belongs to Lewis and Clark Incorporated, the water system, and the four Minnesota members have, while they have four board seats, we certainly can't guarantee the actions of a 20-member board. So that issue has been taken care of. One issue that remains, in State Statute 469-194, there was a provision, or remains a provision, that 50% of any federal funding received would buy down the local share of any debt service issued, or any debt that was issued. Same issue exists. The four Minnesota members certainly can't obligate the actions of a 20-member board into the future. I think I see that as certainly being an easy fix. Another issue, the state aid payment to service debt would be reduced by 1.5% of the adjusted net tax capacity of Rock and Nobles counties. As Senator Scoy indicated, it is highly uncertain as to which entities that have been given bonding authority to complete this project would participate. Consequently, it's going to take the entire $48 million to get the line completed from where the $22 million leaves us to get the project finished in Minnesota. And that number doesn't change regardless of the number of entities that participate. For example, if the City of Worthington would participate alone in issuing debt, there's an issue with the state's debt service aid being reduced by 1.5% of the adjusted net tax capacity of all of Rock County if they're not participating, and the remainder of Nobles County as well. So that's something that we'd brought up. The sales tax issue, one thing that does exist there, the language from last session did authorize the City of Worthington to extend their existing sales tax to generate revenue to service any debt. The statutory expiration of our existing sales tax isn't until May of 2019. So if we were to issue debt this year, we would obviously incur debt service expenses prior to having access to any sales tax revenue to service that debt. Another, I guess, what I would consider to be a key issue, when federal funding basically dwindled to the point we couldn't make any meaningful construction progress, the Lewis and Clark Board looked at a number of other financing mechanisms before we came back to the states, including issuing local debt, commercial lending. We have received word from the federal government that if project members issue debt, future federal funds can be used to repay principal only. They cannot be used to repay interest. As an example, if the project participants were to issue $48 million in debt at, I just utilized 4% interest for a term of 20 years, there would be over $22 million in interest that could never be reimbursed by the federal government. The other thing that could be problematic, whether it's local share, state share, is once we get to the point, which we believe we will, that federal funding will be available to repay the states and the local entities, how are we going to calculate how much of those payments was principal and how much was interest? I know that there's been a lot of talk about the locals stepping up and contributing. I just wanted the committee members to know that to date, the four Minnesota members have contributed nearly $9.2 million to construction of the Lewis and Clark system. Most of those members borrowed their prepayment money. In Worthington's case, we borrowed our nearly $4 million to prepay for this project, and we are servicing that debt right now through the year 2027, and in total, we will have nearly $5.5 million invested in this project just through our 10%, original 10% cost share plus the interest payments. I would, I guess that's really all I have. I would be happy to entertain any questions.
Should, Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I think the technical issues that were brought up can all be resolved. I mean, we can figure out ways to get around the repayment language. We can figure out ways to get around the expiration of Worthington's sales tax. I do want to acknowledge that these communities have committed significant resources to this project. It's not known. We've known that. That was known at the time that we were negotiating this agreement last year. And I think the real crux of the matter is that in order to get the aid payment that would be needed for Worthington to bring water to that city, they would have to bear the entire $1 million local contribution that we figured should be owed on themselves, and they can't afford that. The cities of Laverne and these outlying counties that we were anticipating would be contributing to the local effort are receiving water from the $22 million of bonding money they received last year, and they're not inclined to tax themselves to supply water to the city of Worthington. And they can't go through this Lewis and Clark thing because of the complicated constitution and ownership issue. So we're kind of stuck at, right? Nobody has an answer today. But if the committee would be willing to work with us on this, and I'm going to work with Senator Weber. We had a pretty good meeting yesterday afternoon and met with all of these gentlemen, and I think the issues are all kind of on the table now, and we'll see if we can come up with some answers. What I was hoping is that we'd lay this over for possible inclusion, and we've got some time, and we will continue to work to try to find a solution to this. But I hesitate to say it, but today I don't think we have that. Other than we know there's a serious problem in Worthington. They're under water restrictions already this spring. So, you know, this is not something that's going to go away on its own. We're going to have to kind of work to address it.
Senator Scoy, would you like your other testifier to introduce yourself for the record,
please? My name is Troy Larson, the executive director of the Lewis and Clark Regional Water System, and I'm just up here in case there's any background questions about the project, federal funding, things like that. I'll be happy to provide any background.
Any questions, Senator Nelson?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, that's exactly what I'd be interested in. First, I appreciate the severity of the problem. We can't exist without water. And so my heart goes out to those communities. But I am wondering if you could explain a little bit of the background. It's a mystery to me how just explain the history. You know, how much federal dollars have put in, how many dollars from Minnesota have been put into this project. Why is it that Minnesota hasn't got water, and it sounds like we paid for water for municipalities in other states. Now, I hope I'm wrong about that, but it's a little bit concerning if that's the case. And I'm just wondering if you can give us just a little bit of a background, because it is a bit of a mystery how we got here.
Well, thank you, Senator, for that question.
Please introduce yourself.
Again, Troy Larson.
Thank you.
Lewis and Clark Regional Water. We are, first of all, let me answer that by saying we feel terrible about having to come back to all three states for asking for additional help. The states of Minnesota, South Dakota, Iowa, as well as the 20 members, have prepaid their share of the project, a total of $154 million when you add together the three states and the 20 members. So everyone has done their share. We found ourselves in a situation where the federal government funding was coming in. We've never gotten zero, but it was coming in at such a low pace, as Scott Hain indicated, it wasn't even keeping up with inflation. So that's why we turned to the three states and have asked for additional assistance. So I first want to emphasize how terrible we feel about coming back. In terms of the payments made, the state of South Dakota, out of that $154 million, paid originally just under $32 million. And this past session, they approved an advance of $7.7 million. And last year approved a $1 million advance. So you'd add over the two legislative sessions, $8.7 million on top of $32. The state of Iowa to date has paid $7 million. State of Minnesota, their original contribution was $5.5 million, and then on top of that was last year's $22 million. The locals have paid all 20 members, including all three states, is just over $109 million, and as Scott Hain indicated, of that amount, the Minnesota members have paid $9.2 million, just under $9.2. What's not included in these numbers is because of the delays in receiving federal funding, the members, the non-connected members, have had to invest additional money in infrastructure that they did not plan to. And that's about $17.5 million between the Minnesotans and the Iowans. And I don't have it broken down. The Minnesotans, out of that $17.5 million, the Minnesotans have spent $10.2 million. And again, these are expenses that they would not have needed to incur had Lewis and Clark arrived in time. It does not replace the need for Lewis and Clark. So it's not like they invest this money and now we don't need Lewis and Clark. It was money invested to buy them time. And so it's really insult to injury that they spent $9 million, then they had to spend another $10 million to buy time. So there's certainly a lot of skin in the game. Your other question had to do with where the previous money was spent. No members can receive water without a treatment plant. And the treatment plant is located near Vermilion, South Dakota, in the southeast part of the state. And so, yes, you know, the money that was previously provided by the state and the locals was spent on infrastructure that wasn't in Minnesota, but it was needed to get water eventually to Minnesota. And so hopefully everyone recognizes the importance of where we spent the money. I certainly wouldn't characterize it as the money was spent so Sioux Falls could have water. It's just sequentially we had to build the treatment plant. I think that covered all the, you know, I could provide a lot more background, but I don't know how far in the weeds you want me to go.
Madam Chair. Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you. You gave a lot of information that was helpful. And I do wonder if Minnesota tax dollars have been used at other times to pay for these type of things in other states. And I will just say it is concerning that it appears that there's been a lot of Minnesota dollars that have been sent to other states, and maybe we're at the end of the line. So not to say that this is critically important. It's just concerning to see that, you know, I guess one moral of the story is that you can't rely on federal funding. And I think Senator Skoy probably has some historical information he can add to that.
Senator Skoy.
Well, Senator Nelson, you brought it up right at the end. That's the point of this. You know, we wouldn't be here if the federal government fulfilled its 80%, you know, commitment. And they didn't, but the communities are still there in our state, and, you know, we feel some obligation to try to help them work through this. We've got a mechanism now for them to receive aid. We have to figure out the mechanism for the local contribution that would trigger the aid. And, you know, this is something that I think people that are working in good faith will figure out. But it's going to take some time because it's complicated and it involves multiple jurisdictions, some of which have water and some of which do not. And they have different priorities at that point. And so we're going to have to try to figure this out. But
thank you, Madam Chair. Do we have a total cost estimate of the Lewis and Clark project? I mean, we talked about what's been spent, but I'm curious to see what is the end game for this?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Larson.
The remaining federal cost share is approximately $203 million, and that was a question you asked that I didn't get to. About 3 years ago, that remaining federal cost share was $194 million. The remaining federal cost share is indexed each year for inflation. And so we're on the path to infinity. The number is going up. They've paid to date approximately $212 million, the federal government. So the federal government has paid approximately 51% of its cost share, but that's the remaining. We're pretty much on budget, so the remaining ceiling is what the federal government terms it. The remaining ceiling is what we need to complete the project. And one thing I did not mention is a commitment that's been made by the members is that once all 20 members are connected, most people think that's when the project is completed. We actually have about $33 million worth of work to do once all members are connected. That would be expanding wells, expanding the treatment plant, additional reservoirs. The members have committed to postponing that $33 million of work until all the states have been repaid. And the reason for that is we wanted to provide additional incentive for the federal government to keep contributing. The concern that we heard is if all that's left is to reimburse the states, why would the federal government do that? And so that is a commitment that's been made by the locals that this $33 million of work that we need to finish the project will wait until the states are repaid. And we certainly are committed to doing everything we can to make sure the federal government honors their commitment.
Senator Skoy, did you want to say something?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Gazelka, I draw your attention to page 1, line 13. The cost in the Minnesota contribution was $45 million last year. That has gone to $48 million. Yeah. So those costs are inflating as we wait. But we gave them a little extra, figuring that this wasn't going to happen immediately. But it is an ever-rising cost.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, I'm very much in favor of this project. I think for that region of the state, it's very critical. I'm trying to figure out the total cost. I think it's probably from start to finish about $500 million. Does that sound about right for the number?
Mr. Larson.
Madam Chair, I don't have the figure in front of me, but it's approximately in today's dollars about $570 million
okay.
in total.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, Senator Skoy?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think we've had a good discussion of this, so if we could lay Senate File 1958 mm-hmm. over for possible inclusion, I don't know if there's anybody out there who would wants to testify. Perhaps we should ask, but I think we're pretty well wound down up here.
Okay. Is there are there?
Can I just ask a question, Madam Chair?
Senator Nels.
Senator Skoy, I don't want to take any more time today, but I'm wondering if perhaps we could have counsel or someone tell us, you know, has there, I'm just curious, has there ever been a project like this where other states really fund these plants in other, where states fund plants in other states? And it just seems like a project that was, I'm sure there's a lot more to it than I know, but it just seems like it was destined to fail relying on the feds, we have no control over that. But to have other states pay for infrastructure in a different state, and then we're left trying to connect. So I don't know. Is there ever just, I'm wondering why didn't, I'd just like to know if there's ever any history like this.
Mr. Hain?
Madam Chair. Senator Nelson, I'm not sure that there is a history like this. The $22 million that the legislature approved last year, it was quite a task trying to figure out how to utilize that. How does that all work? But the fact of the matter is there was a common need amongst these communities and rural water systems, and the most effective way to address that need was to work jointly. I understand, you know, the concern. We've got state dollars, dollars that came from the state of Minnesota. We have dollars that came from the four entities in Minnesota that went for construction out of state. But like Mr. Larson indicated, there's no way that Worthington can ever receive water unless a treatment plant is built in Vermilion, South Dakota, and pipeline is built from that treatment plant through South Dakota to get it there. Just if it's any comfort whatsoever, the federal funding advances, the $22 million that we received last year, what we're asking for today, all of that money would be spent on infrastructure within the borders of the state of Minnesota strictly to provide service to the remaining Minnesota members. Nothing gets spent outside the state.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I think Senator it's Nelson. A significant issue. I'm not downplaying how severe this is, and we must get water to our Minnesota communities. I'm just so baffled by the fact that we built a plant in Vermilion, South Dakota.
Appreciate
that's all.
Okay. Senators, we do have a quorum, so Senator Skoy, I would like to move to lay this on the table for
Madam
possible
Chair,
inclusion.
Just lay the Senate file 1958 on the table.
All those in favor?
For possible inclusion.
We don't need a vote. Okay.
Thank you.
Senator Bach, Senate file 650.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a request on behalf of the township of Tofty up on the North Shore that would allow them to create a township HRA to own a senior rental building that they'd like to build. And, you know, kind of everywhere in the state, these are done by local EDAs. Either city or county. There is a city-county EDA joint powers in Cook County, but they really are at the capacity and don't feel they can enter into another ownership of another project because they're in the process of, I think they've issued about $6 million of bonds to renovate the Superior National Golf Course for the EDA at Lutzen. So they're in the middle of that project. I think they've done 9 holes that's going to reopen this spring. Then they will start the construction on one of the other 9s, and they just are really at the maximum of what the county EDA can do. So I have one of my township supervisors here that can explain to you really the challenges that we have. The North Shore has huge housing problems. You know, the government owns 90% of the land in Cook County. And so land is very, very expensive, and projects are very, very hard to develop there. We just can't find private developers that will come and build like other places in the state, Mr. Chairman. There's this wage gap that make you know, market rate projects with market rate rents not possible. And I appreciate that the committee is looking into that larger issue, but Cook County is one of those places in the state that has that challenge. So the town of Tofte has been looking at owning a facility themselves to try and get, I believe it's 12 units of housing established. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I have one of my township supervisors here that could speak to the issue much better than I can.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Block, is the the authority given limited to just this project, or is it an ongoing authority that could be used for other similar projects? Is this kind of like a special law, or is this ongoing?
My intent would be this would be a special law to this one township. I'm not sure if it's it appears to me that it's drafted that way, but if it's not,
it
certainly would be my intent.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, it's not codified, so I just assuming it is for this one project. And if it were successful and you wanted to come back for more, you would have to come back and ask for that authority to be extended to another project. So
that's
very cautious. Very cautious authority given here. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's why I understand it. Section 1.
Thank you.
And Senator Bach, before we go to Ms. Larson, along the lines of what Senator Rest just indicated, that you know, obviously the concern there is that we would have townships from all across the state asking for comparable.
Mr. Chairman, I'm aware of the precedent. We're just here because the town really needs the housing, and we're trying to find a way to get it built. And if the committee has other thoughts about how we can accomplish the same goal, we're absolutely open to consider some other alternative.
Sure. And let's turn to Ms. Larson. And Ms. Larson, maybe you could help us there if you can, in your testimony, if you know. Do you know kind of what the cost of the housing project is and what the gap is between what's currently available and what the project costs are? If you know that, that would be helpful.
Okay.
Ms. Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jeannie Larson. I am a Tofte Township supervisor and also the appointed project manager for our senior housing. Just to do a brief overview, the need for housing for people over 55 was identified in our comprehensive plan in 2005. We have been working diligently on this project for the past 4 years. We are about ready to break ground as soon as the frost lifts. But we received $30,000 in grants from a grant from Lloyd K. Johnson Foundation to do the market study to support whether we can build this and what the market can afford to pay for rent. We received $350,000 from the IRRRB for the infrastructure, which includes for the well and the septic system and the road going in. We have already passed a resolution for up to $1.75 million in tax abatement bonds for this. Depending on what we right now, we show a minimum of a $6,000 gap, which the township can easily probably fund through its rainy day fund that we have. And again, it depends on what our bids come in on for the infrastructure, because we're just in the midst of doing that. We have worked through the land use permit, the PUD, the CUP, the septic system permit. So we do not plan at all to levy for this. We expect that amongst the IRRRB grant funding for the infrastructure, the tax abatement bonds, and the rent that will cover the cost of this. We desperately need this, as Senator Bach indicated. We hope that this would set up a cycle for opening up housing for our younger families to be able to come in and purchase some of these homes. That's one option, but that's where we stand. I have had discussions with our HRA up in Grand Marais. They don't have the staff or the funding to take this on. I also met with One Roof Housing in Duluth, who does projects of this kind, but this didn't fit with their mission. We're kind of running into a situation of who can own and manage this, and that's why we're before you today.
And the bonds that you would be letting would be the 1.75 million?
Up to 1.75 million, yes, that's roughly.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, what's the total cost of the project?
It is...
Ms. Larson.
Excuse me. Let me just look. I don't have...
Approximately.
About 2.25 million, roughly. 2 million, 2.2.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So have you contacted any private companies that might want to work with you with some of the benefits that we are going to provide, or if we pass this, we'll provide for the township, any of that discussion for private businesses that might want to be involved?
Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chairman, no. This project did start with Bremer, this is before my time, and at that time there was something that came up with that project that it was dropped by them. Mm-hmm. So we do, other than any private funding through any small, our companies up there, we have a tourist industry, so, and lumber.
Love the area.
I know. So, no.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. It sounds like, tell me a little bit about Tofty. I've not been there, but I'm looking at the map. It looks like it's right on the north shore of Lake Superior. I would think that would be prime property that the private market would. I think it'd be wonderful to have a property there. So I'm a little surprised why the private market isn't stepping into this.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, the private market is building a lot of stuff along the North Shore, things like Bluefin Bay and Lutzen Mountains and Caribou Highlands and Grand Superior Lodge. Yeah. And there is a lot of condominium-type development that sells for, pick a number, $300,000 to $700,000 a unit. Yeah. What we're trying to create here is some affordable housing for seniors that live on the North Shore, so that if they could get into a senior-type building, it would provide the opportunity for some of the older single-family housing to be able to come available for young people to live there, because the wages in a tourist economy on the North Shore are such that no young person can afford any of the housing that's being built on the North Shore in all of these big resort-type developments that are being built. It's a very unique situation because the land values are so high and the wages are so low that they're just the math doesn't work for anybody that wants to try and develop it.
I see.
It's a very unusual place in the state.
Yeah.
Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, thank you for explaining that, because that's what I was thinking. It looks like a fabulous place. Is the goal of this project then for retirees who would be leaving their homes that would be available to the young? Kind of explain again to me what who the target audience is here.
Oh, yes, Mr. Chairman, the target market is for people over 55, because in Cook County, which is a big county, we only have 5,100 people in the whole county, and Tofty is located at the west end. So if you drove up 61 to come to our community, you'd pass through Schroeder, Tofty, and Lutzen. Tofty has 250 or 80 some people, voting people. There is no place for people over 55 retirees that live in this West End community, let's just say, and specifically Tofty, for them to age in place. They either have to go to Grand Marais, mm-hmm. or if there's something available, Silver Bay, or in the case of our local grocer who ended up retiring, they had to move to Grand Rapids because there's no place for them to go to have a maintenance-free place to live. And this is what we identified in our market survey. The majority of the population up there and from the 2010 census is well over 50. And certainly we're in a cycle where we want to encourage young families to come up there. But as I mean, this is not unique, I believe, to our community, but we do have an aging population. So we really want to be able to encourage people that live, our residents, to be able to have a place to go. Now, Tofty does own the property that this is being built on. It owns, it's about 29 acres. We currently have, the town of Tofty also owns the old elementary school that needed to be closed by the school district. So Tofty purchased that and has turned it into a community center, of which we have a charter school that is rent space there. We have a whole senior center that's being developed. We have senior lunch. And so these 12, six twin patio homes or 12 units would be right near that location, I'd say within about 200 feet of this community center, so that we could provide services to the residents, or they can come down to the community center and feel that this is our version. We're calling it Birch Grove Village, because this way people can stay there. Otherwise, they have to leave. And we also know that their homes can be opened up for families. So as Senator Bach said, all the development that's really going on up there is expensive.
Thank you, Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. So thank you for that. This helps really tie it all together. But I am a little bit still confused on the serving the elderly population, which is so important. We have 10,000 baby boomers hitting 65 every day, each and every day for the next 19 years. So that's going to continue to grow. The homes that the 55-plus or the baby boomers crowd would be leaving, and that I think this bill might be targeted to, are there homes part of these costly, expensive homes on the North Shore?
No.
Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chairman, the homes that would be sold would be at your lower end homes. These are not the $500,000 to $1 million homes that have been built up there by people who have basically second homes.
Okay. So my last comment, Mr. Chair. So I really do appreciate the history on this. And what I'm wondering is the bill says that individuals over 55 or family members of someone over 55, but it also says or with incomes not greater than 120%. And so my comment would be it would make more sense, I think, to have and in that position rather than or, because it looks like the bill in its current state, anyone over age 55 would be able to participate and purchase one of these taxpayer subsidized spots. And so that was kind of my concern that I would consider that it'd be helpful if that was a and, because HRAs are typically, I think, to help low income homeowners.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify,
Ms. Larson,
these are rental. They are not for ownership. We're looking to the town to have the housing authority to own and manage it, Tofty Township, yep. And they are rental properties.
Okay. Thank you. So it'd still be the same, though, that we
Senator
would
North.
Not want to subsidize the high-income elderly who are able to pay full market rent without some sort of public subsidy.
Well, Mr. Anything Chairman, else, Senator Bach? Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, the thing I didn't look at is that language that starts on line 1.15 to 1.18 where it says 120% of the median family income in the county of which Tofte is located. I don't know what the median family income in Cook County is, but I can tell you it's pretty low. Yep. And I think this language is consistent with the way other HRA buildings are operated. I know in other senior-type developments, the HRAs are allowed to put, if they have vacancies, are allowed to put people that aren't seniors in order to fill the occupancy. And I think that really is the intent here in the event that there's vacancies, that to provide some opportunity for other low-income people to be in it to make sure the building is full.
So, Mr. Chair, maybe that could be clarified in the bill, in that just in the case of vacancies. Thank you.
That certainly is the intent.
Senator Bach.
Thank you.
Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 650? Anything else, Senator Bach?
No.
Okay. Anything else, members? Thank you, Senator Bach. Thank you for traveling, Ms. Larson. Chair will lay Senate File 650 over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Rest. Let's see Senator Sparks. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chair, can I just mention,
Senator Sanger.
Mr. Chair, when I get to be 55, I would love to go to Tofte and and live in one of these units.
To the members and to the public, Senate File 1369 is not going to be heard today. So if anybody's here for Senate File 1369, we're not hearing that today. Senator Rest.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File 389 is a proposal to exempt from the sales tax a legally required seats that parents and others are required to buy to transport children who are 8 and under and weigh I think it's and or weigh less than 49 pounds. We in 2009 changed the law to require additional children to be secured in automobiles and other vehicles with car seats that are federally for which there are federal requirements, and they're quite strict. You can't, if you have a used one, it has to even has to be things like all the tags that were on it when it was bought new have to be on it. You have to have personally known the person or the people who own the car seat before you, and so forth. We currently exempt from the sales tax other products that that we use for the care of children, diapers, baby bottles, etc. And a constituent presented this issue to me, and it seemed like to me that this was a natural extension of the sales tax exemptions with regard to products that we use for children. So the Department of Revenue, I guess, indicates that the average cost would be about $90. However, you can, it's possible to pay $329 for a car seat. You can pay as little as $50, $44.98. There is a wide range, and the ones on this page from this advertisement range from $29, which is just a booster seat, to up to $150. So I think that the consumer, my constituent, made a very good case for us to consider exempting the federally required, with the federal requirements still in place, not touching those at all, from the sales tax. The revenue cost indicates that it's about $1 million a year. So it seems to me it's a gesture, just like some of the other products that we exempt from the sales tax for the care of children, to include these required, you know, they're not an option, these required apparatus that need to be in cars and other vehicles.
Thank you, Senator Russ. Questions, members? Anyone wish to testify in opposition to Senate File 389? Looks like you're good to go, Senator Rest.
Good. Happy to hear it.
Thank you very much. Senator Rest, Chair will lay Senate File 389 over for possible inclusion. Senator Sparks. Welcome, Senator Sparks. Workforce housing.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 1968. I do have the A2 author's amendment that Senate Counsel was kind enough to put together for me that fixes some issues that they noticed for me. So if we could offer that amendment, that would be helpful.
Sure. Do we have that? First stop, Senator Sparks.
Yes, for this bill, yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Marty moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The A2 is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This legislation is one component of a larger strategy to address the lack of workforce housing in greater Minnesota. The tax credit will help attract, private dollars to bridge the funding gap that is preventing projects from moving forward. A similar credit has been implemented in other states and has proven successful. If it is okay with you, Mr. Chair, and members, I'd like to turn it over to my testifier to explain what the bill does and how it will help in cities like Austin and other greater Minnesota cities. I have with me Craig Clark, the Austin City Administrator, and also Dan Dorman, the Executive Director, to talk some more about the bill.
And who would like to go first? Mr. Dorman?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, former Representative.
Pleased to be here. Thank you for taking the time to hear the bill, and thank you, Senator Sparks, for agreeing to author the bill. My name is Dan Dorman. I'm the executive director of the Greater Minnesota Partnership. We have roughly 100 members, chambers of commerce, EDAs, businesses, nonprofits throughout Greater Minnesota. We work on economic development issues, trying to get more people working for better paying jobs in Greater Minnesota. And one of the things that we have found, it really doesn't matter where you go, and I'm sure that I'm not telling you anything you don't already know, is that in Greater Minnesota we've had for some time a problem with workforce housing, and it is starting to have a detrimental impact on job fulfillment. Since 2006 in Greater Minnesota, the job vacancy rate is up over, well, now it's up over 60%, meaning there's all these unfilled jobs out there, and part of getting somebody to work is having a place to live. And it is not about, this isn't a variation of low-income housing, it's about workforce housing. It's about people that have income that would like a nice place to live and often will go to another community because they couldn't find one. I live in Albert Lea, and I know there's a really nice Section 8 building that's all rent-controlled. And every spring or summer when the new teachers are hired, I talked to the manager of that building, and he said it's like clockwork. He can tell when the contracts are issued because they're down knocking on that door saying, boy, this looks like a nice place. I'd like, you know, new teacher in town, I'd like to rent. And yes, they can't do it. And then, well, we'll pay you market rate. We'll pay you more. Can't do it. And so the problem we have in Albert Lea, we hear about from the medical center with entry-level or beginning nurses, school district. So it's not people flipping burgers. That's not what we're talking about. It's people that have good-paying jobs that the market has not responded. And so we think it's a failure of the market for a variety of reasons that we'd be happy to discuss with you if you want to get into that part of it. We believe it's a market failure, and the easiest solution we think is using tax credits to stimulate I'll say a market-based response to this, using tax credits to stimulate more development in workforce housing in these communities. And they range from, you know, our part of the state, Austin and Albert Lea, to Moorhead and Worthington and all up on Thief River Falls and Roseau, and you just can't go anywhere in Greater Minnesota without hearing about this problem. And so the bill that you have before you, working with Senate staff and Senator Scoy and Senator Sparks, actually is a little bit different than the bill that we originally introduced, and I think it's there's an important improvement in this bill. It's a 40% tax credit if you're just a real estate investor. But if you're an employer in that community and you're going to put skin in the game, you're going to say, boy, I'm going to pull my checkbook out and I'm writing a check because I think this needs to get done, and you agree to create jobs, 10 jobs in each year for 3 years and maintain these jobs, you can get an extra 10%. We call it like a 10% kicker to really try to incentivize that local business to continue to invest in their community. And that's what it's about. There's one employer in Jackson, Minnesota, AGCO. When I went out and talked to them about their problem, 26% of their workforce now comes from more than 30 miles away. They're a large multinational corporation. They got plants all over the place. He didn't say what I'm about to say. I'm going to cut down to what the reality is. They can create jobs in a lot of places. They want to create them in Minnesota because we've got an outstanding workforce. We've got great people, and they want to grow here. But I said, we need the community to grow. We think we can grow some jobs, but this community, in this case Jackson, it's got to grow. We can't go 40 miles out and 50 miles out to get employees. We need people to locate, live, raise a family here, pay taxes. And so, Mr. Chair, that's the basic part of this is the tax credits. It's a 40% credit for, I'll just say, the investor, or a 50% credit if you agree to create and maintain jobs.
Thank you, Mr. Dorman. Senator Gazalka.
Yeah, just thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dorman, one question for clarification. So if an employer of company ABC wants to build housing for them, that's what you're talking about, then they get an extra credit? I want to make sure I understand that part.
Mr. Dorman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazalka, what would really, how this would work in practical terms would be the company would really probably set up a real estate investment company, and they would own and operate or find somebody to operate the property for them. So it would be they would be investing. They couldn't limit it to just their employees. There would be a benefit to the community in general. But in order to get that extra 10%, they would have to add and maintain jobs.
Yeah, thank you.
Regardless of who lived there.
Mr. Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Craig Clark, City Administrator for Austin. Austin and many parts of Greater Minnesota haven't seen market rate housing since bell bottoms were hip. Our housing market is broken, as testament from the lack of market rate housing being constructed. This provision before you today will help grow jobs and incentivize work, and also while working with the private sector to provide a solution to our housing challenges. We have challenges at all across different income thresholds, whether it be low to moderate income, but specifically before you today, this market rate housing is something that's particularly of interest to us so that we can spur those folks and those jobs and grow our businesses. Cost of construction and low prevailing rents and a lack of developer capacity have often been the commonplace in our rural communities. We have vacancy rates in the single digits of our existing rental housing stock, and we've seen an explosion in job vacancy rates in Greater Minnesota. This is an important economic development tool to bridge the gap and spur this job growth. We need an approach that addresses both affordable, and we appreciate the legislature's addressing that last session, but we also need some attention for workforce housing, and we appreciate that support. We're glad that this proposal has the measure within deed, because we do see it as an economic development tool. And thank you for your time and consideration of this important legislation.
Thank you. And Senator Sparks or Mr. Dorman, you know, we did a pilot project last year up in the northwest corner, and we developed some criteria. I see the criteria in this bill are different from the pilot project. Do you know why you chose to use different criteria from what we did in the pilot project last year? Were there some technical problems with that, or do you know that? Mr. Dorman.
Mr. Chair, I think one of the differences would be trying to geographically target last year where that money went, and so it was defined a little differently in order to get it to a certain geographic area of the state. This is, I would say, broader only in the fact that it addresses the same issue just in more parts of the state, but it is limited somewhat to cities that have a large number of. So we looked at how do you get there, and so we looked at a ratio of jobs to population, and if you have more than 40%, meaning you've got, you know, some communities like Perham actually have more jobs in the community than they have population, and so we looked at that ratio as a way to try to, you know, their housing needs all over, can't be everything to everybody, and one way to limit it, but also cover more parts of the state than last year. So I think that's one of the primary changes, Mr. Chair.
We might continue to work with you, Senator Sparks, on that to make sure we understand what the goal is here.
I think we can further refine it
and see if there's
well.
Some issues there. There's a couple other things. What was the analysis on the ask? I mean, you're asking for $50 million ongoing. Have you done some kind of research to see how many number of units that would do and what the need is out there? And then also, in the same vein, there's a cap of $250,000 a unit. Have you done some thought on where that number came from? What's going on there?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In reverse order, and I think that we want to work with you and massage that $250,000 either to a lower number or make it clear that it's expressing we're trying to get people to build more than just one-bedroom apartments. And so we limit it to at least $75,000 because we don't want poor construction, but we're not trying to, and I'll use the medical analogy, we're trying to create workforce housing for that entry-level nurse or beginning nurse, not the beginning doctor. So we're not trying to do a real high-end housing. I would point out, though, and I could be off by a little bit, but I heard testimony in the House from Minnesota Housing Finance, and their average cost per unit in greater Minnesota is actually $238,000, which seems a little high. So I think that we would like to work with you between now and when your bill comes out and try to find a way to make sure that, you know, we really shouldn't have to build $250,000 one-bedroom apartments. That's not what we need to do, but we want to make sure that there are two- and three-bedroom apartments built as well. So I think that area of the bill could use a little more work. And the other question?
Well, Mr. Dorman, what I'm interested in is, you know,
how many?
Well, I mean, you're asking for $50 million. I think that'll, and just kind of roughly, that'd be 1,200 or some number of units a year. And to be honest with you, my hope is that if the state is a player in developing workforce housing in rural Minnesota, that what the result will be is a demonstration to the finance community that these things can cash flow on their own. And so we want to find the right spot on the funding and the financing and how many units it takes to demonstrate that, and hence the question about how much money we need to put in and how many units you think it would, you know, we're going to be developing in every year so we can get to the right point there. And Mr. Dorman, if you have some answers there, if we can do this later, that's fine also.
Sure. Mr. Chair, to the part of what research we do to get to the number, we looked at what other states were doing, North Dakota, Iowa, and others, looked at the need. If my math is correct, we believe this would create somewhere in – it could create more, by the way, but at a minimum of 4,000 to 6,000 units. We've heard from, again, Housing Finance that the number of workforce housing units needed is a multiple of that several times. And our hope is, like yours, is that 3 years from now we'll hopefully be here saying we don't need to do this anymore because the market is functioning better, we're able to get more comparables. That's one of the problems with, you mentioned the Roseau project, that's like a $4.2 million project, wouldn't get the appraisal, came back, I believe, at $2.8 million because you can't get a decent comparable. If you were to go to Albert Lea, and I know there's some cities trying to work with somebody to get this done, the best comparable is 30 years old. It is not a comparable, and so you don't get an appraisal that really is bankable. It's a problem. We think this will stimulate the market. We shouldn't have to be, you know, I think like low-income homeless is an ongoing problem we always have to work on. This shouldn't be. We believe that if we stimulate the market for a few years, that we should be able to back this out and the market should take over and develop workforce housing like it does in the metro area a little better.
Very good. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, with our discussion yesterday about using tax for policy reasons, this is a good example of how we do it every day, and I think it's a good idea. I have some questions similar to, I think, some others about how you pick the $75,000, $250,000, and so on. I do like your idea of the employer who invests in it getting a little higher bump. I'm just curious, the 40% and the 50%, why not 30 and 40 or 50 and 60?
It's scalable.
Yeah, I mean, how did you pick those numbers? Is thinking that that's where it makes it work and that doesn't. Just curious.
Mr. Dorman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Marty. We patterned a little bit after Iowa and North Dakota, and frankly, North Dakota's got 100%. It's more of a low-income deal, but they actually have 100% tax credit. That seems a little bit excessive. It's like, you know, then you're just really directing, here's where I want my state tax dollars to go, that debt. I'm kind of a salesman, but I'm not that good. And, I don't think I could say that with a straight face. And Iowa's at 30%, and so I'd like to tell you that it was, you know, we hired a herd of analysis to come in and get there, but it wasn't that fine of a point where I thought, well, this maybe makes some sense to meet here in the middle. But they're certainly open to discussion on that point.
Mr. Chair, I think the chair's comment about trying to figure out the right numbers before we do it, the $50 million type of thing, I think trying to figure out what works in some of these projects, I don't think that means you do one this year and one next year and so on, because I realize the need is great, but I also think a lot of this is trying to estimate things. I did have one specific question asking for understanding, because I think it doesn't make sense, the language on page 2.27. A ratio is two numbers, jobs to population ratio, is 40 greater than 40%. That's like saying a Vikings-Packer game score is Vikings 12. You need another number. I'm wondering what the... what is meant by that 40%? In other words, 40% more jobs than population? Okay. So in other words, 140
right.
to 4 to 100 kind of thing.
Right.
Okay. Mr. Dorman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, that's correct. It would be a percentage of jobs, private sector jobs, in population.
But Mr. Chair, I think that does
Senator Marty.
Clarification, just because that's not technically what it says, but I think I get the meaning now.
We'll clarify that language, Senator Marty. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know that we need to address as a state the issues of workforce housing. Just one aside comment, I don't take North Dakota as a model for anything. I mean, their workforce housing is in total crisis, and the state could build those units themselves without any help anywhere, even though right now their oil is in their oil industry is in a slide. So Iowa is a more reasonable look at it, in my mind, rather than a state like North Dakota, which is a total outlier to what we're experiencing here in Minnesota. I would be interested in knowing or in considering that we would take as a definition of Greater Minnesota in this instance and in another instance, which I'll refer to in a moment, the 10-county metropolitan area or the 10-county area and not just the 7-county area. I don't see that those... the communities in the collar counties are are outside of what I would call the metropolitan market and able to make these cash flows. I see this more as a gift to them rather than an incentive to buy. And in addition, And Senator Sparks, I know you're familiar with Senator Stump's workforce housing TIF bill, establishing a special kind of economic development district, 10, 11 years, whatever it was. And, Mr. Chairman, what I hope we will do is certainly address these issues, but to do it in a comprehensive manner so that we look at what the relationship will possibly be between those communities using tax increment financing, if we do this workforce housing economic development districts, coupled with this, so that we understand that these programs not only will exist in parallel, but that they are part of a comprehensive approach to workforce housing. And it may well be that if we're doing that and examining those costs and benefits, that we can be more careful in not duplicating what we're proposing and bring that cost way down from $50 million. Mm-hmm. I can see the programs acting in conjunction with one another, but I don't want to see us doing something where the one program exists as if the other one does not. And so I hope that, you know, when we put this together, we're going to have a comprehensive workforce housing article in our tax bill, and not just put Senator Stump's workforce housing TIF in a TIF article. It doesn't belong there. It belongs with considerations in this proposal, and to see how they work together, whether projects that are begun because of the economic development TIF districts, the degree to which a program like this helps them. And the cities take that into account. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that is an easy task, but I don't think we need to look at duplicating efforts, rewarding or incentivizing the exact same behavior, and to see which one for the taxpayers is more efficient and effective in achieving the goals. And I think we're probably going to need both, but I would like our pencils to be really sharp for how we go about putting those together.
Any comments, Senator Sparks or Mr. Darman, to Senator Rest? And I think, I don't know if you're tracking or not, but Senator Stump has the workforce housing TIF that we're contemplating, and we want, as Senator Rest indicated, these programs to be working together to fill the gap that's needed now. And as I indicated earlier, we're thinking that some of this will be not needed in the future. And so, Mr. Darman?
Right. I would agree with many of the things that Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I would agree with many of the things that Senator Rest said. In the, I'll say the bigger bill, it had more of the, we have a bill that had the grants and everything all lumped into one. There is some language in there that I think eventually will be in the final product that would say that, you know, indeed, you've got these different tools, don't use them all. You know, which tool needs to work in this community, because they can work together, but, you know, you don't want to triple dip either and just see all the money flow to one or two projects versus additional projects. And so I think TIF can be part of the discussion in and of itself. I don't think it will do enough to stimulate the market, but I do understand your concerns and have the same interests.
Senator Rest.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this bill has already been separated. Is that correct, Senator Sparks? Some of it is in Senator Tomasoni's division.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sparks, that is correct. We sent the tax provisions here, but there's another bill sitting in Senator Tomasoni's committee that does have the grant proposal.
So, Mr. Chairman, then once again, I think we need to be, even if we would only be carrying tax increment provisions and tax credit provisions, that we need to be looking at what the whole package is, so that, again, we're doing it with the most efficient use of taxpayers' dollars and not duplicating those dollars for without compelling reason to do so. So I hope we will look at Senator Tomasoni's bill with regard to that and then put them together with, as Mr. Dorman just talked about, this whole package, rather than thinking that this is the only basket we have, or that the only basket the tax committee has is the tax credits and the tax increment, while in another committee something else is also going on that we need to be fully aware of when we are putting together our bill. So I think there needs to be a lot of discussion with Senator Tomasoni and his committee with regard to what direction does the Senate want to go as a body, not necessarily just the tax committee or Senator Tomasoni's division.
And Senator Ress, both Senator Sparks and I are on Senator Tomasoni's committee, so we will pay attention to what he's doing.
Thank you.
Senator Koenig?
Mr. Chairman, I do have an amendment at the appropriate time. So.
I think now is the time.
Okay, it's the A3 amendment.
Senator Koenig, what's the A3 amendment accomplishing?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And what that does is adds border cities to the bill. If you look on page 2, line 30, after the word authority, it adds or cities defined in section 4.691.166.
And Senator Koenig, what exactly does that do, and why do we need to add those words? Are there communities that are not going to be allowed to participate in this? Mr. Dorman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the amendment from Senator Koenig, thank you. The one city that we're concerned about how it would work, and we think it makes sense that this work for that community, would be Moorhead. And I'm not sure about the other communities. I didn't have a chance to look at all of them. We thought it might be easier just to include the cities that have the border city designation to add that clarifying language. But it would add the city of Moorhead as to make it clear that they qualify. We think they do anyway, but it really just adds the clarification that they would qualify.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand why a border city would need to be specified out, even though perhaps it didn't meet the other criteria. We heard in the Jobs, Ag, and Rural Development Committee, Senator Sparks, you'll certainly recall the initiative from Senator Eakin, that in Moorhead, it actually costs $25,000 more for a single-family home because of the 2009 energy code that we have adopted and the other code, I believe it was the International Building Code, that have made single-family homes $25,000 more to construct in Minnesota than across the river in our neighboring state. And so I think that is significant, but I also think it is a very important point. As we talk about affordable housing and workforce housing in this state, we need to look at the things that we have done as the state legislature, as a state government, in making affordable housing less affordable in our state. Now, I don't know what all is included in that 2009 energy code and that international building code. I think that's the sprinklers that has made a single-family home $25,000 more to construct in Minnesota than across the river. And I think that's an issue that we should be addressing. I think that is a significant issue as we talk about affordable housing, is taking a look at what we are doing to make housing less affordable.
And Do you serve on Commerce?
No.
Senator North Nelson?
No.
Be a request for next year meeting.
Yes.
So with regard to the A3 amendment, we will vote on this and see if it goes in. But, Senator Sparks, my plan and my notes are to have a conversation with you about the geography of this bill. And Senator Ress brought up the different counties within the metropolitan area that we need to have conversations about. She had thoughts about offering that as amendment today. We have the Senator Coonan amendment in front of us. So we are going to have conversations about which communities are going to qualify for this. And irrespective of what we do with the amendment of Senator Coonan's today, this area and geographic area is all going to be up for conversation that Senator Sparks and the committee will be having as this moves forward. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Dorman, just had one question. I was talking with Senate Counsel. To get the sense of what your intent was on the job, the housing shortage issue on page
Senator,
two.
Senator Mark, can we do the amendment first?
Oh,
is that
I'm
on
sorry.
The amendment?
I'm sorry.
Senator Coonan moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The A3 is adopted. Senator Marty, sorry about
that. Mr. Chair, Mr. Dorman, I was just trying to get a sense of the jobs to population ratio issue we were talking about. Did you mean, is it terms of jobs versus the total population or jobs versus the employable age folks? Or, in other words, what kind of number were you looking for there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty.
Mr. Dorman.
Private sector jobs, what we focused on, and private sector jobs, total population, because it was the easiest way to get at to. It's a couple clicks on the deed website. We looked at other ways. There might be a better, conceptually I can think of better ways maybe to do that, but it's much harder to find that data. So I think that we looked for ways that so a community wouldn't have to go out and spend $50,000 to demonstrate that they qualified. So it may not be the most precise way. I think we could probably come up with a more precise measure if we were willing to forego the, as a ease, because we're not doing it just for simplicity's sake, but it's more difficult. We looked at several other ways and couldn't really find anything that made sense.
Mr. Chair, maybe we can have you connect with Senate Counsel and so on in terms of what your intent is. I agree with the simplicity in figuring out what the number is, just trying to figure out what you were thinking of is an appropriate amount of more jobs than housing available for the
right.
workers kind of thing.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, the one thing that we've thought about, but it's the way it is now, is making the change to total jobs, not just private sector jobs, because that would impact, if you think about communities like Moore has a good one, because you've got a lot of public employees. And so I'm not married to that provision. There may be better ways to do that. We're certainly looking for improvements.
Senator Marty?
That's fine.
I want to go back to the question about the differences between the pilot project, and I guess I have a specific question. And in that pilot project, we had a question about how many market rate housing units had been built in the last 5 years, and we were trying to get a feel for what the market rate housing development was like in these communities, and if there was market rate housing being built, that perhaps there wouldn't be as much need for this. And that is not in the current version of this bill. And do you have a reason that was not included, or is there something that we aren't understanding about that provision? Mr. Dorman?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't think it was excluded for any other than we were looking for a way to limit it with the percentage, but I understand the point that you're making and think that we should take a look at that, because I do understand what you're saying, because clearly there's a difference between what's happening in some of our larger regional centers versus what's happening in communities like Elberly and Austin and Roseau and things that are smaller. I mean, there are, I understand.
Sure. And Senator Sparks,
not
we're
sure
going
to get there, but I understand.
Yeah, we're going to continue to work on this, and we'll stay in touch and see if we can get some further information on some of these questions.
Mr. Chair, I agree totally. I appreciate you giving it a thorough vetting today, and I obviously took Senator Rest's points well, and I think, like you said, we know that this is an important issue, but we want to make sure that with the help of the Tax Committee that we get this done if we can and get it done right. So I appreciate you guys hearing the bill this morning.
Anything else, members? Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have a question. I'm not sure either for Senate Counsel or Fiscal Staff or perhaps Representative Dorman or Sparks. In I think some communities, mine being one of them, the local community foundation is very bad. You know, it's their lead project, affordable housing. And so they work with the county HRA in terms of projects. And frankly, looking at this, even projects well outside of Rochester into Moore County, Wabasha County, and Goodhue County, and so on. So it's a more of a regional kind of look. But that's not my real question. It's okay if a small business or even an individual wanted to. Well, I can't go into. I don't want to get into the housing business, but I want to help the housing need. And so I'm going to donate $100,000, $500,000, pick your number, to the local foundation, and they're going to work with the HRA, and we're going to have a housing project within our county or area or whatever it might be. Would that donation to either a business donation or an individual donation, would that be credited at these rates, 40 or 50, whatever the case might be, for an employer, or would that donation be handled as a contribution to a private organization, foundation?
Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair and Senator Senjum, that type of donation would apply if the entity to which it was donated qualified as a qualified workforce housing project, as that's defined in this bill on 2.19. And that is a designation made by deed. And so if the community development HRA, for example, met those criteria, then the investment would qualify under this tax credit.
Okay. And I think in most cases, at least I'm familiar with, they probably would qualify as that kind of a project. Thank you very much.
Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File Number 1968 as amended? Anything else, members? Thank you, Senator Sparks. Thank you, Mr. Clark, for traveling. Thank you, Mr. Dorman. Chair will lay Senate File Number 1968 as amended over for possible inclusion, and we'll continue this effort.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Nothing else in front of the committee. We are meeting next Tuesday for additional member bills, I believe. And there's the possibility of a Wednesday meeting, but we don't know. We'll see how Tuesday goes. If we can get everything done on Tuesday, we probably wouldn't meet on Wednesday. Committee's adjourned.